Welcome to the Voices from Afghanistan series, a five-part audio blog where we explore stories from Wisconsin veterans who served in Afghanistan from 2001 to the present. My name is Matthew Scharf. I'm joined by Rachel Halaska.
Hi.
And Tristan Krause.
Hi.
We are the summer interns for the Wisconsin Veterans Museum Oral History Program. Thank you for listening.
The war in Afghanistan is the longest-standing military conflict in United States history, starting in 2001 and still going on today. In July 2016, the Obama administration capped troop levels at 8,400 service members. In June of 2017, President Donald Trump gave authority to Secretary of Defense James Mattis to reevaluate troop levels needed in Afghanistan as part of Operation Resolute Support. Given this development, we decided this was an appropriate time to look back at the historical record of this conflict.
All the segments in this series were taken from full-length interviews from the Wisconsin Veterans Museum Oral History Collection. These interviews provide firsthand accounts and insights on the conflict in Afghanistan. This series will contain graphic descriptions and language that may not be appropriate for all audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
This installment will cover Wisconsin veterans' impression of the enemy in Afghanistan. We have incorporated stories from interviews with three veterans. These clips include detailed descriptions of the Taliban, their military and political tactics, their organizational structure, and personnel makeup.
This first clip is from John Vandeloup, a finance officer with the Army National Guard who deployed to Afghanistan in 2004. He discusses Taliban tactics and seasonal changes in combat pacing.
We had that initial contact, and then we were told that depending on the winter, that it would fall off because they don't like to conduct their ops in the winter time for obvious reasons of snow in the mountains where they can go run and hide. I mean, it gets quite deep and it's hard to traverse. So from November through March, other than the occasional rockets, nothing. And then starting that April time frame when the snow started melting and they started filtering back, the rocket attacks picked up, and then with the advent of the IEDs becoming so popular at that time in Iraq, they started picking it up on over there. And all of a sudden our convoys back and forth to Kabul got a little bit more dicey because, we had a few of our convoys IED'd. No casualties, but thank God. But so that part picked up. The only other time that we were aware of their presence, real close by, as we went downtown one day, and the streets were littered with, and people had in their hands flyers that the Taliban came down and said, basically gave them to them, and in Dari or Pashto said, we see you cavorting with the Americans, you're going to die.
Next, John McNally, a Special Forces team commander, describes Russian and Pakistani influence in Afghanistan, interactions between Taliban fighters and the local population, and tracking high-value targets.
The communists were coming down. Russian, oil delegations were coming into the country, 90 or 100 guys, and they're advisors.
I shouldn't think they'd be very well received. Russians don't have a very good reputation.
Well, not with the Afghans, but with the Taliban. Mm. They were getting support from the Soviets as far as advising them. Influence is coming from all over the place, trying just to maintain that instability. And, they want the Taliban to win, and then who knows from there. Another thing they started directing were border meetings with the Pakistanis, because we wanted to, show a good face, I guess, with the Pakistanis. And so they would tell us, well, we need to go down there and meet with them. Well, the problem with that is that you send up your report, your operations order of when and how you're going to get there with the route to the American side. When there's a Pakistan liaison officer up at the three-star level in Afghanistan, that Pakistani liaison officer sends it to his side in Pakistan, and the guys on the ground know that the ISI are in deep with the Taliban. Now, pretty much certain that the bad guys have your route, they know when you're coming, and you just set yourself up for failure for an IED or an ambush, and yet it's our own guys, our own side that's dictating. And some guys, that happened to. They had IEDs, they found them in the road, along the route that they were going to go to this border meeting. Well, what did you expect? You have
might as well put it in the paper.
Right. And that happens sometimes. We would go into... we would go into a valley, and the local people would know of a big operation that was going to happen 30 days from when we got there before we would know. We would go into this valley and start talking to locals, and locals would go, when's the big operation coming? When are the guys, the airborne, coming? We hadn't heard anything about it. We go, they are coming. Oh, yeah, they are. We heard. Well, I would set up a report that night saying, hey, what's going on in this area? Well, there's something going to go on in 30 days. Well, the gig's up because... Yeah, you know, everyone in the valley.
Everybody
knows.
In the valley, good guy and bad guy.
Right, and 2 days before this is going to happen, all the bad guys are going to get out of town, and you're not going
to. They don't have to go any sooner either.
No, because they know. You know, where are they getting that intelligence? Well, there's, yeah, all these liaison officers of the highest level. That first deployment, because it was just after the Taliban were kicked out, it was similar to the Wild West. You know, we had you didn't know who was who. You had guys running all over the place with guns and. Like, what's going on?
How do you know a Taliban from a friendly?
You don't know. It's almost impossible until he shoots at you. Yeah, they're not wearing a uniform. So, other than local intelligence and locals telling you, well, there's some bad guys here.
Yeah, but that's a good way to get rid of your brother-in-law.
For sure. Well, that's because of that. There's a mentality over there. They hold grudges for 17, 20 years. And so, if you're not careful, they're just going to pit you against their neighbor because they're having a problem with them.
Sure.
And sure, you know, everyone can lead anyone to a cache over there because everyone has AKs and mines stashed. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're Taliban and they're going to use them against you.
Right.
They have them stashed because they know what the country's gone through in the last 20 years, which is nothing but warring. So it's more of a self-preservation.
More than 20 years. Yeah. But you sense the Taliban are just marking time till we leave? I know you said... Some of the warlords are, but they probably
yes.
know about the Taliban.
Yes, and the Taliban are too.
Okay.
And the Taliban know, they have a shadow government set up. It's that well structured. And the frustrating thing is, you know, the Special Forces have been fighting in there since late 2001. And we've been, you know, you report to hire saying there's a shadow government you already established. They have... It's a full-blown insurgency. They've got the underground operatives. They have, you know, runners. They have people from the opium. They're getting the money to train, to recruit new people, buy weapons. And you report to your higher end. It took them a while. I think just recently that the Department of Defense started acknowledging that, yeah, there's an insurgency going on because they wanted to go straight from We got the Taliban out of the country to we are rebuilding the country now. Well, there are, you know, in military doctrine, there are a couple of phases in between there that once you get the Taliban out, they have an insurgency going on. You can't start rebuilding the country until you're not being shot at. And if you're still being shot at, then there's still an insurgency going on. So now I'm setting up. One, I don't want them to know that we're going after this. This is going to be a high-value target. You got a Pakistani general who's recruiting for the Taliban. And any time that higher hears that you're going to go after an HVT, well, you have other so-called you have Delta Force or the SEALs over there, and their main priority is to go after high-value targets. So they want it, and they want it not only because that's their job, but they want it to justify their existence in country. And because they have priority resources, oftentimes if an SF team who's on the ground, who knows the lay of the land, who knows the intelligence reports, if we would report something like that, they would snatch it from us and say, and they can't respond within the 12 hours that we need to go get this guy, they would confine us to that safe house. You guys can't go anywhere outside a 2 kilometer radius now. Then they would send these guys in, and everyone knows who they are. Late. They would come a day later. They would be in the area for 4 days asking us all types of information, and then they would go out for a couple of days going after Osama bin Laden or the HVT. Because Osama, we got a lot of intelligence reports that Osama was in our area. And so sometimes we would be 4 hours behind, and we'd send up a intelligence report saying, hey, we're going out to Osama. We know. And then they would say, nope, you're confined to your safe house.
SEALs go get him.
SEALs go get him. Or Delta go get him.
He's gone.
And he's gone. He only stays in the area for 4 hours, and he's gone. That's it. But that happened with this Pakistani general. I sent up the operations order.
Oh, so you didn't get to do it?
No, we didn't get to do this because I sent out the operations order, kind of side-skirting the issue of who this was. I didn't want to say who it was. I just said, we're going after this
guy.
You
had seals all over.
Right. And but it just sounded to them. They smelled it out that this was going to be a direct action. We're taking this guy down. So they came back with, we want more information. So I told the warrant, I was like, you know, what should I do? And he goes, well, just send them all the information. Yeah, he said, yeah, basically, you shouldn't even told them. We should have just gone and get them. But then, you know, then you're in a bind there. If something goes wrong, you get your hand slapped. You, damn if you do, damn if you don't. But, but the funny thing is, you're trying to do the right thing. You're trying to prosecute this war. But because of paperwork and bureaucracy, that's what happened. I sent
this
operation.
The SEALs board. Got better training, probably, right?
But No, they don't.
They don't have any better training than you guys. Well, then why the hell not send you guys in?
They should. But it's infighting right now between the different services over there and who's going to get the big guys. And, well, if we're spending all this money and we have all these resources given to the SEALs, then they should be the ones to catch them. Well, maybe if they're in the right position, but what's the objective here? To get the bad guys or to make... confirm the why they're here. It's just so it was very frustrating for the teams because you know you're
you have the resources, you have the ability, you know where and when.
You spend months developing intelligence.
It's 2 kilometers too far.
And they would hamstring you. And this happened a couple times to my team, and I heard it happening to other teams as well.
Lastly, Michael Gourley, a National Guard military advisor, provides a description of Taliban recruits, their political and religious beliefs, and potential conflict with warlords and their militias in addition to the Taliban.
We had, after the winter of 04-05, there was a drastic increase in the insurgency. That's where, in my estimation, the insurgency really started. You had your initial invasion by the American Army at the beginning, and then things kind of slowed down. But if you ever take a look at graphs and combat action and casualties, you'll see a rapid, drastic increase in the early part of 05, and that was the increase in the insurgency that was pouring over from Pakistan. That kind of confused us at the time. The nationalities of the insurgency went all the way from Pakistanis to Iranians to Chechens. I mean, there was a wide variety, and from Saudi Arabia. You know, they recruited and got them wherever they could get them. Yeah. And we would find identification on those enemy soldiers that covered those basic nationalities, and, along with the Afghanis, you know, or the Taliban themselves.
So what I'm really interested in also is, I guess, your perception of the Taliban. If I were going to ask you to describe the Taliban, who you were fighting over there, how would you describe them?
I guess the first way I would describe them is on a political spectrum, and mm-hmm. intended to be, you know, if we were comparing them to our political spectrum, they tended to be on the far right wing. They had very strong beliefs about behavior, about dress, about the role of women, and with little tolerance for deviation from that. And they believed in obedience and kind of totalitarianism. So, and they were vocal, and they were very, I mean, when they believe in Sharia law being enforced and ruled with an iron hand. So very inflexible and very strongly believing in their mission and what it was they wanted to do and how they wanted to govern. And they believed that you could take from the population and manipulate the population in such a way so that you could remain in power and not have your power contested in any shape, form, or fashion. Ways of doing that is discouraging education from the masses, but only for the elite, those that were part of the system, no education for women, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
I see. Now, what about the tactics that I'm assuming these are members of the Taliban who are attacking you, or people who sympathize with them. Mm-hmm. What was their tactics?
Well, it not only initially were those that were Taliban or sympathized with the Taliban, but you also had the whole issue initially in country where you were fighting or possibly fighting, you didn't know, militias of the warlords, who were very powerful at the time. By the time we left, we pretty much demilitarized the warlords. But when we first got there, one of our responsibilities was working with our Afghan forces, and through a lot of wheeling and dealing to demilitarize the warlords. But initially, they were a big factor in what went on. Many of the times that we actually came under fire, we didn't know who it was. You just didn't know whether it was somebody taking pot shots at you, whether it was Taliban, whether it was insurgents, whether it was, you don't know. You just know they're firing at you, and therefore they're not being very kind to you.
Right.
And you got to do what you got to do.
Yeah.
If you or someone you know is interested in donating materials or taking part in a veteran interview, please contact the museum. If you enjoy listening to this installment, listen to our past installments and be on the lookout for additional installments in the Voices from Afghanistan series. Thanks for listening.